Welcome to another edition of Dolphinville. Dolphinville Radio, going out over the waves, frequencies of planet Gaia. Right here in the solar system as we float through the galaxy of time and space. We're here today joined by some very special star people who are here to share some of the information that they've accumulated over a lifetime of living on planet Earth to bring in some very high frequency information that will maybe help us adjust to some of the things that are coming into our consciousness at this time. We are moving into a higher frequency of awareness. Our individual human consciousness is starting to grasp newer levels of awareness. And in doing so, we're looking for ways to explain what's happening to us. So it's very important to be able to tune in to the different vibrational frequencies. So as my guest today, and I welcome both Lawrence Kennedy and Sandra Sisman to the show, welcome star people.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yes. What we'll be doing today is going over some of the wealth of information that Lawrence and Sandra have accumulated over a lifetime's experience. They have been part of the mainstream, if you will, or the cutting edge of this new informational front that has been hitting planet Gaia for these last 25 years more intensely. Probably since the mid-80s, we can see evidence that there's been a dramatic shift in what people are open to and the type of information that's coming in. Such centers as Sedona, Arizona, and Mount Shasta have taken on a new level of resonance, people flocking to these places to get information or vibrational information. And lo and behold, Lawrence and Sandra are often seen in these places at conferences and gatherings of people to share the information that they've come into. So today we'll be getting involved with what we're talking about with the star people. First, let me remind everybody again that this program is being hosted by Photon.net, an internet service provider. Randy is the operator, as usual, bringing these sound waves and hopefully keeping it clear and steady pulse out there. I would encourage anybody to check out Photon.net. And if you're not already a member of Dolphinville.com, which is the broadcast point for this radio station, I'd encourage you to check it out. If you are a member, you can go into the site and access all of the archival files from these radio shows that have been going on since December, starting with Joan Ocean and having some fascinating guests. And we hope to continue to add to that list. And without further ado now, let us go ahead and move into some fascinating information and welcome Lawrence Kennedy and Sandra Sisman to the show. Thanks for coming to Hawaii, Lawrence.
Thank you.
Yeah. Now, Lawrence is going to be passing the mic back and forth between Sandra, but for the time being, I wanted to focus on the core of information that they're bringing here. Lawrence seems to be the spokesperson for being able to verbalize. Sandra has been here as a support and an energy holder. She's been able to organize their tours. You guys have been on the road for a long time. It's about 35 years for you. Is that right?
32, I think, this year.
Mm-hmm. And it all started with a rather dramatic event in your life. You shared it with us the last couple of days. It started with what is the classically known now as the near-death experience. Nobody even knew what that meant back then. When you had, was it a major coronary or something equally as severe that took your life away,
yes.
Right?
It wasn't a coronary.
No, it wasn't coronary. It was two duodenal ulcers had hemorrhaged simultaneously.
Mm.
And I had ulcers even when I was a teenager, but they were peptic ulcers. And they're not as dangerous. A lot of people tolerate those. But I formulated the others through very bad habits as an advertising executive. And
the three martini lunches, right?
Which I have since abandoned all that. And it's taken me probably 30 years to build the body back up from the destructive 10 or 15 years.
Mm-hmm. But prior to that, prior to going into the advertising industry, you mentioned that you were in the Air Force as a pilot, so you had some firsthand flyboy experience.
Yes, I went in cadets to be a fighter pilot, and I got my wings and in a T-33, which is an antique now in the museums, the old F-80 that we used in Korea, I think one of our first jets. And then we graduated into high-altitude pressure checks. And the reason is they were going to full instrumentation night flight, which is common today but was new then.
Mm-hmm.
And we're talking back in the 50s here, 57, see?
Mm-hmm.
And so I developed a cold from too much night studies. I was not real good in geometry and, calculus and trig, which was necessary for navigation. And I was studying under a blanket at night when everybody else was sleeping. And then they get us up at 3 o'clock in the morning and run us, you know. I developed a cold, I should have checked myself out with a flight surgeon and didn't, and decided I wanted to get it over with. And so I went up anyway, and my nose was all stuffed up and oxygen mask over it. And I couldn't breathe properly, so I just did a real quick, you know, like that back to clear my nose, and both of them hemorrhaged simultaneously at that altitude. And I obviously was not using my noodle on that one, and it looked like I was bleeding to death. And my instructor turned around and looked behind him, and because he heard this bubbling in the microphone, and it looked like somebody had slit my throat all down the front of my flight suit. So he put it in a crash dive and called the tower and cleared the runway. And by the time I got down, I'd passed out on the way down. Well, the bottom line was that they grounded me. They said I signed up for 20 years, and so they had $250,000 invested in me already. And they said, well, you're going to end up spending the rest of the 20 years flying a desk. And you got your commission, you got your wings, and it's all right. And I said, no, it isn't all right. So I went to court, and I went in under contract, which is a rare thing because only 2 years did they do that. And so I challenged them on the contract, and a colonel represented me and proved that I could fly low-altitude aircraft. Which was not that much available. The only thing that was really available was choppers. And they said, as a flyboy, you know, you don't want to fly choppers. Those things are like flying a washing machine. Besides that, they're all backwards. Everything's back. You have to go back through school and they're all over again, you know. And I said, well, if it's in the air, that's what I want to do.
But didn't you have a near-death experience during this crash dive?
Actually, no. That wasn't a near-death experience. It was after that, about a year and a half to 2 years after that, I got caught in an explosion. And in doing air sea rescue, which is what the chopper pilots do, or at that what I had selected to do, it's hazardous duty. Mm-hmm. And for lousy $50 a month, I laid my life on the line. And so nobody can quite figure out, you know, why they do that.
It makes you sound pretty ancient. I don't know about things.
Okay.
Well, so we've got in some ancient things. We'll get in some real ancient things here.
It started me off learning some things about the medical, because I became a paramedic, and it was necessary in saving lives too. And we not just military. It was during peacetime, but it was the only it was the only setup besides the ammo loaders that were getting or the ones that handled nuclear weapons, extra pay, okay, and during peacetime. But in civilian use, we had a lot of incidents occur where we had to get involved in civilian rescues too. And so it became kind of a foundation for me to understand the life-saving factors and what the human body will tolerate and so forth.
So from there, you got involved in the commercial art and advertising industry for about a dozen years, and that led you down several different avenues of expression. But then you had this life-changing and life-altering experience where you literally had this altar explode, where you were faced with the classic example of the light at the end of the tunnel.
Yes.
Tell us about that experience a little bit and the entities that you met during that time.
Well, I had abused my body in 10 years. I had taken a perfectly healthy cadet body into destruction by all the vices. I mean, I was into everything except illicit drugs. And I didn't have to worry about that because I had five internists that I was going to that were feeding me even experimental stuff and tranquilizers. And I'm mixing that with alcohol, and they should have known better, but they did it. And so it was pretty hard. It's amazing to me now, looking back, that I had the stamina, you know, to stand up under all that. But it came to a head, and the reason that I feel is created in the first place now, of course, with what I know now, is because I have a very sensitive nature. I have a moon that is in Cancer, and a Scorpio rising as an example, and that combination is makes me sensitive, and so I use my sensitivity to make money actually, because I could sense what was creative wise. I could sense what a person needed in their as an identification in advertising, so to speak. Mm-hmm. And so, but I knew that it wasn't, I had all the toys and I had big money, I was making big money, and in line for vice presidency of one of the largest agencies in Los Angeles and one of the biggest. And so you would say I was on the road to success, but on the other end of it, I was paying the price. And I wasn't aware of it, that, I mean, really, I don't think, because I didn't have a conscious death wish. Well, it all came to a head, and all of a sudden I just had, in my wife's condo, which we were already separated because of tensions along those lines, I had two duodenal ulcers, hemorrhage, and it was like the next thing I found myself up in the corner of the room looking down on my body.
Classic scenario that people have reported.
Yeah. Yes. Well, yeah, it was a relief, really, because I never realized, I don't think you do consciously realize when you're walling yourself in, so to speak, or something, what's really going on. And then all of a sudden, when all that's removed, the ego or what, you know, so to speak, and then it's a different perspective.
Okay. You didn't want to go back, you said.
No, I didn't want to go back. I was glad to be rid of that. It's the impression was sort of like if you have an old car that you were forced to drive, that was really a lemon or a junker, and then one day, you know, your aunt dies or something, leaves you money, and you go and buy a new car, and you see that one going out the driveway with a wrecker. Uh-huh. You don't even look twice, you know, sayonara.
But you met some entities along the way who told you otherwise, that you had stuff to do back on this plane.
Yes, two entities appeared to me on the other side. I went through the tunnel, went toward the light. It was a very cosmic experience. I couldn't get enough of it, wanted more of it, but you don't get, if you get to the light, at least that's my impression and understanding, you don't come back if you merge with it completely. Well, I did not, and along the way, two entities appeared to me, and my impression is that we travel through different dimensions on this astral trip. And so the fifth dimensional travel, I believe, is where I was probably going through. These two entities, I would describe them as being, I mean, you could say they were extraterrestrials. They were different. They were human form, but they were different. And they're described in Brad Steiger's book, Destined to Love, okay, which describes why Sandra and I are doing what we're doing. and so I won't go into all that unless you want to cover that. And so basically what they look like, and I did last night, and so they basically told me I needed to go back. They had told me basically they knew me from before, and after I got over the initial shock, which you do have the emotional shocks on the other side, then I followed those instructions reluctantly, but I did. And I found myself back in being resuscitated. And the paramedic said, well, we were actually gave up on you, but your ex-wife kept insisting that this guy is too stubborn to die. You know, you're going to bring him back. And so they said they spent a long time on me. I almost broke a record, you know. And so they had resuscitated me, and I came back with everything on hold, which was kind of, what I mean by that is that the pain that I had doubled up in a fetal position and forced me out of my body was gone. But the condition had to be worked with. But about a week later, I went to, I didn't tell this last night, but I went back to the doctor that had been keeping x-rays on my ulcers and condition for 5 years. And I had neglected recently going to him from getting updated. I hated those barium upper and lower GI shots. And so I went back to him and had a upper and lower GI, and he called me in and said, we're going to have to do this again. And I said, oh, God, I hate that. I said, why? You know, he said, well, it didn't come out right. And I said, well, get your equipment together, will you? You know, I don't want to do this again. So he did it again, and then he calls me up and he said, I don't know how to tell you this, but I'm going to have to bring in an expert. We did it. We're getting the photos are coming out, but I don't understand. It doesn't match your previous. It's like you're somebody else. It doesn't match your previous x-rays. And I said, oh. So the third time, I passed out on this cute little nurse with one of my open, rear open type of gowns, passed right out on her, you know, and fell right on her like this and ended up on the floor because that barium stuff is bad news and this couldn't take anymore. But he got the third set anyway. That was at the end of the x-rays. And then he had the expert in there and they sat down and they looked at the table and he said, we don't know what to tell you, but we've looked at all three sets. Your ulcers are not there. And it's impossible. Okay, it just doesn't happen. So we just don't know what to say. We don't know if we should give up the practice or what, you know?
You defied the laws of physics. You had a cellular adjustment on the other side to allow you to come back and, you know, kind of reconstitute and get the vehicle back on the trail. Because there were some important things that were coming up for you at that time. Now, you went on to develop some very interesting things with the Clarion photography and a whole school of psychic development in Lake Tahoe. Now, that was immediately following this experience?
But, you know, the thing that goes along with that is I learned that you can't abuse the assistance. So I had to get, you know, what really saved my life, of course, that was the beginning, obvious, but the continuation of that, total diet change. I completely gave up my drinking habit, smoking habit. I practically lived on coffee and prime rib and lobster and all the wrong things. And all of it stopped immediately. If I gained, the biggest thing I gained out of it was kind of a willpower boost, if you wish, you know, that gave me a different perspective of this. See, these addictions are I don't know if they're part exactly, if they're an integrated part of your ego that you just are exactly what. I have one of my degrees is in psychology, and I've tried to analyze this, and the closest I can come to it is calling a Huna expression of low self, you know, is that low self gets addicted, and through the choice of the middle self director, okay, which is our conscious mind. And so with that, the ego becomes dependent upon these things. And so they just were gone, and I didn't miss them, although I have to say that even to this day, if I smell fresh brewed coffee in the morning, it gets my attention, but I don't drink it, okay? And I have gone back recently in the last few years to a glass of wine with dinner, but nothing excessive.
Sure. Well, you made the mention of something I thought that was very, very curious about the perception on the other side that the material world was the illusion and the astral plane was the real reality, and that changed everything around.
Yeah, it's really hard to explain. I think that's why I even sounded like an idiot to myself, telling it, because there was nothing established, no accreditation to it at that point. Moody had not written their book yet, etc., none of the others. And so,
well, it's Buddhist that the material world is an illusion.
That's right.
I mean, you know, in basis. So the philosophy has been out there. But in practice, on the Western front, I mean, unless you were a follower of Alan Watts, that was foreign territory.
That's right. So when you see, when you actually see it face to face, but again, it could have been my illusion, you see, and until certain hardcore things like that x-ray and so forth started materializing to demonstrate that, it later proved to me, these things proved to me, or proved themselves out, that I wasn't hallucinating these things, okay? That they were real, because if they weren't real, how could I manifest them, you see? Or like my guidance, if it's just some kind of a secondary voice in my head, you know, schizophrenia trip or something like that, then how come when I do what it says and these things manifest? Mm-hmm. Okay? So, I mean, that's the kind of thing I was wrestling with. Mm-hmm. Those are the demons, although I never had the feeling of having to deal with demons. It was always a high experience.
Well, one has the demons. I think you would probably say the linear constructs of the mind, the ego, is the demon that insists on controlling something that is not really in its realm of control.
That's right.
Yeah.
Everything that I had thought was real exactly flipped. 180 turned a completely rotation and became the illusion. And everything that I had learned or respected in the academic as being the illusionist, psychic stuff, you know, and all that, woo-woo stuff, became the reality. And so that you could see through, or whatever, the ghost image, or the flip-flop of the negative, of the positive. However, and it's like the expression I used last night, I've searched for ways to try to explain this to people. It's even today, and the only thing I can think of is like with Toto and the Wizard of Oz pulling the curtain aside. I actually did see there's no real curtain, but there's a veil, and I could see through this veil, and that you see things as they really are, and not as the illusion that we're constricted to see.
There's also a Huna saying that says what we believe is true. John Lilly elaborated on it by his famous statement now, in the province of the mind, what we believe true becomes true within certain limitations. So, in effect, from the other side, the astral level, the dream time, as the Aboriginals would call it, we are literally can predict what and dictate what the material reality then becomes. And this would be the nature of your work for the psychic development, wouldn't it?
That's right. It was the groundwork. So that what it's sort of like if you were trying to build or construct something and you only were able to see it, like I think they wrote a book a long time ago that I read in Flatlanders, okay, where you see everything in two-dimensional, and suddenly, you know, you emerge as a three-dimensional aspect and it puts it in a whole different perspective. Mm-hmm. That's what it was.
So you stepped out of Flatland and now you're in another multi-dimensional matrix here.
Right.
What was the first thing? I think you said that you went on and got a doctorate degree, and was it parapsychology or?
Yes. It was a way to save my sanity, because here I am in a brave new world, and I have no foundation for it whatsoever. The academic gave me no foundation. I have a master's degree in philosophy, and I went from psychology. There wasn't the psychology did not have the answers, so I didn't pursue it. I went into advanced psychology, and then I took a look one day. This was before the death experience, of course, and I took a look one day, and I said, you know, all my professors and my peers that I am aware of are all going to shrinks. So I don't think they have the answers, you see? And so I moved on to the next thing, which was the next best thing at that time in the academic, was philosophy, which is man's construct of reality, okay? Which is just, again, it's just an opinion, right? So to speak, and there's lots of it out there. Everything is philosophy, right? So if you just you kind of just vacillate on that one, you see. So I embraced that one. Well, I was allowed to bridge, offered to bridge. There was only three universities at the time that were offering abridgments to parapsychology, and so I bridged mine and picked up 10 years gap on it to parapsychology. That was the closest thing, and yet I still don't consider myself, even as my doctor, as a parapsychologist.
Well, Stanford was doing research. Yeah. Was this one of the universities then?
Yeah, I've gone more in the direction of a classification that really doesn't exist officially as paraphysics. Mm-hmm. See, because parapsychology meaning above psychology or extension of. Well, I think more, I've been working more in not so much of the extension of the mind, although that has been a big part of it, but I've graduated into the physics of things. You see, so paraphysics would be a closer definition, mm-hmm. but I don't have a degree in that.
Mm-hmm. Well, obviously, a lot of the physical objects that you've developed are not tangibly provable in hard science terms.
No.
So it would be difficult for it to be classified as physics, so paraphysics would seem to be an appropriate term. But getting back to the experience, after you had the near-death experience, you came back, it changed your life, altered your cellular structure, you were on a new pathway to a different way of looking and dealing with the world around you. Did you find that the degree in parapsychology allowed you to access more readily these realms, the so-called guides, the guided spirits? Could you go back and get in touch with the entities, for example?
I had to start all over again because the only thing I was going by was my own little world that had formulated from the death experience. And I had nothing to bounce it off of, no reality to bounce it off of, nobody I could go to and say, what do you think about this? Or, you know, because their reality was completely different. So I had to seek out people from a credentialed point of view, so to speak, in alignment, peers, that, and I had mentors that were professors that were already experienced in these areas. And so I pursued a lot of beginning things with, like, ghost chasing, you know. But it gave me a foundation to realize that that was a waste of time, in a sense. I have to say it was kind of an amusing thing until you get a handle on it. And my spiritual part of it is that it's not important. It's a distraction, you know, in a sense. The astral world is quite complex. And we did some pretty advanced training in that area. We're manifesting collective thought forms so we can actually create our own spirits, which shows that, you know, a lot of what we experience as hauntings or whatever are really manifestations of thought forms that are collective thought forms, okay? And I put a lot of that in my first book called Terror in Transition, but it's about the planet and the areas that are traumatized on the planet from war and pestilence and just general negative concentration. You find the cities and the decadence and how that creates weak spots on the planet itself. I mean, just like the breaks in the Clarion aura, you
exactly.
See? They have parallel.
Well, I do want to get into the Clarion aspects of your work. This is something I assume that you came in contact with when you were studying in the parapsychology things, and then it led to your actually working with the Clarion photography and developing a way of reading these auras. But before we get into that, we're going to take a little bit of break here, allow the listeners to get up, stretch, maybe get a glass of water. We'll come back after a couple of minutes of listening to the Starseed music of Andrew Forrest, and appropriately so, we'll be able to get in some of the star-seeded information that we have to share here. So be right back in a few. we're back, and I want to bring everybody's attention back to where we are. We're with Lawrence Kennedy, the developer of the Kennedy-Kerlian technique. After years of research, Dr. Kennedy discovered that the fingertips could be charted, similar to Dr. Bernard Jensen's system of charting the eyes, which is known as iridology. Since you had been working with this technology and firsthand, you also developed an electronic device, which was a portable briefcase-size Kerlian machine that you could do on-site diagnosis. Now, this is after years and years of development, but take us through what started your interest in the Kerlian photography and how you saw it as a tool that you could start using for helping people.
First, I have to kind of usurp it and say that a lot of people wonder how I can, in this short time, this lifespan so far, how I could possibly have become an authority on so many different things. And like lasers as an example, which usually takes a lifetime of dedication to, especially in the early days of it. And this was only possible because and from the very onset, I was led to these things. And not only they led me to these things and opened up the door, but they would lead the people to me. If I didn't, one way or the other, it would confront it. And they use some really tricky stuff sometimes. So this is an example with the Kerlian research. Here I was working with, did my doctorate work on the Geller children, bioelectronics. And Dr. Thelma Moss at UCLA had come back from the Soviet Union and got a 10-year grant at UCLA Medical Research to see if there was a diagnostic capability that could come out of Kerlian. And by the way, it's called, we call it electrophotography, but it's, everybody else calls it Kerlian photography, and it's because Samian Kerlian was accredited with it, but he was not the inventor. The Soviets had this nasty habit of picking up things and taking credit for them, but they do a lot of things that we don't get into, and so it's our own fault. What happened is that she could not get the kind of caliber person that she wanted all the time with a low budget on a grant. And so Geri Geller was one that she had targeted because him famous Israeli psychic from the 70s who is bending metal and all kinds of things like that. And he was on a world tour and demanding way too much money for his agents. So she had to wait, and she was processing certain people like Olga Wirl, who a famous healer at the time who could bend laser beams with her hands and magnetics and so forth and transfer energy from coast to coast and so forth in petri dishes, increase, speed up the production.
Cool.
So she would take pictures of the famous healers that she could get her hands on, and she started with healers and then went to paranormal people like Geller, or if she could get somebody like that. She couldn't get Geller at the time, so the next thing that came down the line is we had already had a reputation brewing because of the work of my son and had hit front page newspapers in the Orange County area, and there was documentaries being created. And so she had heard about it and contacted me, and asked me to bring in some of the Geller children, which my own son was one of the most spectacular ones. I found out he became kind of my guidepost. It was, again, there's no accidents. All this cooperation stuff, even with my own son.
The Geller children, for people who don't know, were sort of like the earlier prototypes of the now called Indigo children. Is that correct?
Yeah, Indigos are, as I said last night, are a graduation. Third generation, you might say. I try to make it clear that this whole thing is an evolving thing. And started off, I coined Brad Steiger's, his acceptance of that, the word star people, because I certainly did not like the word that I had chosen, aliens, from the ones in my classes that were obviously that. Because of that, when that movie broke, it just was so negative. So I had to switch. And then the next generation, of course, from the Geller children or that identification, or star people to Geller children, and then the Indigos. And I think that the Indigos, because, and I didn't talk about this last night, and I wanted to, but how they're coming from the blue race. If you want to tap into that at some point, we can come back to that.
Okay, and let's get back to the Clarion story with the Geller children.
The blue race, I've got information on that. And so, at any rate, I brought in my son and had him tested and photographed. And she had a great big isolation chamber, like a Faraday cage that had been built by Kendall Johnson. He was a highly skilled electronics person at UCLA, and he had built this elaborate thing, and the great big sealed room to keep out everything except for when that's what a Faraday cage does. And then this big machine with all these dials on it and everything that produced high voltage, and probably I think it was around 50,000 volts, I think, is all it was producing. That's all that's necessary, is about 25,000. Anyway, so we proceeded, and then she saw what my son could do, so we just kept extending all the possibilities.
What is it that he could do?
Well, he got the most famous write-ups, I guess you might say, are the ones press paid the most. They actually coined the press. One of the second editors, or whatever they call it, assistant editors, I think, of the Anaheim Bulletin and the Santa Ana Register also picked it up, coined the word psychic explosion. And they did that because they walked right in. Again, there's no accidents. The timing was perfect, okay? I was with them, and they just came in to meet Chris, and he was right at the edge of having all this happen. I mean, just as we knocked on the door, he about jumped out of his skin because he was hearing everything rattling all over the house, banging and rattling. It's like some kind of monstrous ghost was going through a poltergeist-like, which I had referenced last night as I don't believe poltergeist is the correct definition at all, which is a Iskarden spirit that it raises havoc with and uses a child's sexual energy at puberty to manifest things. I have proven every which way that with 900 people that is not what it is, okay? So that I have graduated through my classes not using poltergeist. Okay, so.
Spoons started exploding, bending, chandeliers,
right.
Everything started going nuts.
Everything in the drawers were as they were in trays, but they raised like a mountain raises like that. Mm-hmm. In a bend position up, or twisted in circles. The things were laying loose, it was a mess. We had nothing to eat with, and stuff that shouldn't be able to bend, stainless steel stuff bent. You know, it's bizarre. And then we had cookware that old military stuff that's really strong. You know, the old military stuff, camping cookware. All ready to go. I was going to take him camping that weekend, and it was like some big giant had tromped around him, smashed it on top of it, you know. So, and a fireplace poker curled up in a kind of a semicircle, you know. So they came in right in the middle of this happening, which is pretty freaky, I mean, for press people, and led by Stuart Robb, who is a very highly respected professor, parapsychologist, and so forth. And working through the university. So they grab pictures like crazy, and they hit the front page. And I got to tell you, the Anaheim Bulletin, not so much as the Santa Ana Register, that editor would not put an article in there about psychokinesis or UFOs even if one sat down in front of him, you know. But he did this one because he witnessed it. It blew his mind, okay? So that's how it started. And so suddenly Chris went way off the scale of what we were working with, individual spoon bending, so to speak, analysis, fire starting. He did many things beyond that. He probably one of the most documented, probably the best thing, was an incident, the biggest thing, with making a documentary film with Captain Edgar Mitchell, the astronaut, in 1976, I believe it was. And in making this film, his leading producer had put together this that was that he was shooting different people. Like Mitchell, they put him in the hotel room right alongside of me, and they used the Hollywood tower which is looks like a stack of records, a circle.
Oh, Tower of Records.
Tower of Records, yes, Billy. And we used that. And so after the shoot was done, or at some point, maybe in the middle, we had dinner. And everybody got to kind of rub shoulders and friendly with each other. And there were several people there besides Captain Edgar Mitchell doing other things. And I think like Dr. Ray Brown, he's dead now, had discovered the Atlantean crystal out in the Gulf of Mexico underwater. I don't know if you've heard of any of that.
I have heard of that. It was okay. Like a one-time shot, right?
So it was something else to be rubbing shoulders with these people early on like that and getting some foundation. Anyway, we were having dinner, and Mitchell took a real liking to Chris, and he was sitting, and Chris was only 14 by this time, and he was sitting alongside of him, and Chris was sitting right next to the railing. I was sitting across from him, and the restaurant rotates around a circular center that they serve from an elevated. Okay, rotates, and there's this little white gate that's half table height that moves. And if you get a hold of the gate, you'll notice your arm moving with it, very slow pace. And they just bounce back and forth between the openings. Okay, so Mitchell was talking to Chris about some of the things that he had heard about that Chris could do. Chris did the number of things that were captured by the press. He could use his eyes as laser beams and explode bottles at 15 feet. And he could make big doors, cargo doors, metal doors, rattle from clear across the room and big auditorium. Just like a giant was on the back of pushing like that. Those are things documented by the press that they asked him to do. And he was so innocent about it, he'd just say, okay, I'll try it. I'll try it. And so Mitchell said, what do you think the biggest thing you can do? And Chris said, I don't know. My dad always told me I could capable of doing anything. That was my flaw. I told him he could do anything. He believed me.
Your flaw, I suppose. Yeah.
Right. And so Mitchell said, looked over at the rail and he said, could you stop this room from turning? Okay. And Chris's reaction was, oh, I'll try. He was so naive, the press loved him because of that, you know. He just reached over and grabbed a hold of that railing and stopped. And we were all kind of holding our breath. And about 3 minutes went by, you know. And the room wasn't moving. But nobody was, it wasn't making a fuss anywhere. I guess the waiters going back and forth didn't pay attention. And nobody was really, they were all busy in conversation. And pretty soon I got this flash in my head, and I could see a picture of gears smoking and clutches burning down the stairs and $1 million tab for the lunch. So, I mean, it was just a picture.
Yeah.
But I went, Chris, I reached over his hand. I think that's enough. And he let go, and it started moving again.
Wow.
You know?
Yeah.
Now, obviously, there's some kind of a slide clutch situation to this room that if something obstructs it, it stops. But I don't think you can hold it back, because a couple of other people there, the producer as well, tried to hold it, and the arm just goes with it. You can try strength in
sure.
the hand.
Well, now the natural question is, what is Chris doing these days?
Mm-hmm. Yes. Well, he's in Nashville, Tennessee. He's been there since my granddaughter was born there. She's now starting to look like she might be blossoming into something interesting, but we're kind of holding back on it because she really doesn't know that much about her dad's past. I mean, in that part of his past. And he did this on purpose because I had to take him out of the circuit, off the circuit when he was still in high school. Because the government paid an unhealthy interest in him, okay, our government, and the KGB was camping out as well in our out on the street watching us, and it got pretty a lot of intrigue, and I didn't think that was a healthy way. I raised him myself as a bachelor father. I didn't think it was a good way to have him continue to go there that way. So I just decided to put him in retirement for temporarily at least, and it just manifested that way. And he decided to pursue it after a lot of searching in different areas, he decided to pursue his talent in music. He was really natural in music. And he just picked up a guitar, and I just showed him some of the keys, and next thing you know, he started playing. And so he started to play, and he went to, and he wrote music, and he sent some of his music to Nashville, and a publisher bought it, and with an option on the rest of it. And the next thing you know, he's there, and my granddaughter was born there 15 years ago now. And he writes a progressive country with a message. It's hidden, in a sense. What I mean by that is it's not like the normal country music. It's progressive, and it definitely it has a message to it.
Well, so his so-called psychic and kinesis ability, then he stopped using it, or he just uses it to pass the fork along.
Continued, I think that it would have forced an issue. Because there was obviously, I didn't realize what all was going on. Some of my sources of intelligence, some were telling me that at very high levels that there was this. If our government can't use him as a counterforce, they don't want the Soviets to have him. Okay, see, and so that was a big threat. And so I just pulled him off, and for years, I think we were still being observed as which direction we were going in, and I just kept him off, and then for his own safety's sake.
Mm-hmm. Well, maybe that was the best thing, to save his life rather than put him up on the front, because as soon as you said he's rattling big power doors and able to bend metal, certainly there's an application that the military would be very, very interested in. So we kind of jumped off a little bit. I think it's interesting for the listeners to hear some of the information that you're sharing, certainly about your son. But you were on a path as a teacher for psychic development. And this kind of led from the Curlian photography, and then you developed a whole series of classes. Now, I wasn't quite understanding why it was 900 people or 5 years, but you said after that level of teaching, it was over. Were you shown that that's how many you were going to do? And can you tell us about how that came about? Were you given guidance to do this school?
Well, I guess it would start when I was trying to use Chris as a counterforce, in a sense, or across as a polarity force for me in using a pyramid as a focus. And I had gotten into sacred geometry, and I realized you could use pyramids as a focus. So from that point on, I used them in my classes, a big 12-foot pyramid with a gold capstone. And the first one I tried really was a little smaller, and it was a smaller class. And I put together, I was doing these seminars and lectures and seminars in the Southern California area and living in Laguna Beach. And I moved to Laguna Beach because my son became a surfer. He loved it, just like I did. And so people who had come to some of these lectures and seminars had asked about, is it possible to learn this? And I said, yes, that's what I was told. And from on a small demonstration basis, I was able to do this. Geller children, or just children in general, are easy. You just hand it to them. They see somebody else do it. Kids are wonderful with mimicking. They're open, without prejudice. It's easy. Adults have already formulated all their hang-ups, right, and their restrictions, and most of it's religion, okay? And so, boy, it's like pulling teeth. And I don't care how anxious they are to want to do it, especially intellect is your biggest enemy, because if you try to intellectualize it, you defeat it. You see, it's exactly opposite of that. So once I discovered the perimeters here, again through my son, and then I formed the first little experimental class, and I handpicked the people because one of them, or two of them actually, the father and son, were already doing psychokinesis. And they just didn't know what to do with it. And a little bit of automatic writing. So they wanted to clarify it. They wanted to manifest it into something that was usable, like healing and something. And so the wife decided to take the class too. Cause I still am in touch with them today, and they're in Spokane, Washington. And and then Chris, and then a lady by the name of Margaret O'Brien, not the movie star, but a very well-known hypnotist, medical and theater hypnotist that was big time in the 70s, okay, even into the 80s, before she went into retirement. And so I formulated a small with only six people, including my son and myself. And we did the first class. And the results of that first class leaked out. I'm not going to go into the details, but again, it's a setup, okay? And National Geographic's got a hold of it. And they sent the producer over and asked if they could film the show. And I said, well, I only did one class, and it was an experiment. I haven't made up my mind yet if I'm going to do any more. It was just to see if we could do it. And they said, well, can you repeat it for the purpose of the camera? I said, I suppose we could, using the same people. I'm not sure what it's going to accomplish as a refresher course, but everybody wanted to do it again. And it wasn't just to be on camera. So today, it was released back in the, I think the first time was something like around 78, and 77, 78. And it was called, they released part of it, National Geographic's paid for it, and they released part of it on a program called Wide World of Adventure. And it was mainstream prime time. And then they did it. They took the rest of it and put it on a science documentary, college level, university level, which is available today. And so from that formulation, I then, my guidance indicated that I needed to do more of these, okay? So I was directed to Lake Tahoe for its energy as a vortex, and also my energy had paralleled it, as I mentioned last night with astrological influences, okay, astrocartography. I found out afterwards that I was operating absolutely supreme in my energy right at the lake.
What was the guidance then? When you speak about guidance and your guides, are these the same entities you saw when you went over to the other side? Or have they changed? And do they actually tell you, okay, go to Tahoe or start these classes, 5 years, 900 people? How did that work?
It's a mixture. It's an interesting whole bag of tricks, literally. Shouldn't maybe use that word, but it's thoughts that come in, pictures that come in, clairvoyantly, so to speak. And my clairvoyance was being developed. And as far as the people, the ones that originated helped me to a certain point. By the time I was ready to do the classes, they had, as they had promised, they had graduated. There's two others had come in and taken their place. And in doing that, these people were coaching me on the way to formulate the classes. And I never got to see what they really looked like. I only heard or telepathic transmission picture. So unlike the first two, I didn't know what they looked like. I was always curious. And it also started the automatic writing training, which went on for 7 months and 7 years. All throughout the same period of time. And that was to get the ego out of the way. Poetry is right brain, and it would come through in perfect rhythm and rhyme. And even with five different notable personalities, I mean, obviously different. One of them wrote, I'm right-handed. One of them wrote upside down and backwards like my son, left-handed, you know? And yet it came through lightning speed and perfect rhythm. And it was beautiful stuff. I loved it. But after a while, after the 7 years, I was asking, getting a little impatient with it. What do you want me to do with this? I had published it into a little book when I got involved in the Myers case that was called Closer Encounters of the Fourth Kind. Closer Encounters. A little booklet for my classes. I was reluctant to go out mainstream with it. And the pictures of the Myers cases were in there, which we're going to bring up.
We will talk a little bit about the rather infamous Billy Myers UFO and Pleiadian connection here. But before we get there, I know that during the same period, during the late 80s, you were also being drawn into the fascination with Egypt. And that also led to a special journey to Egypt. So both the Myers case, which came, I believe you said, a little bit after the Egyptian experience.
No, first.
So you were already involved with the Myers case, and then the Egyptian thing came along.
Yeah, again, it's a setup. It gets humorous after a while. You just know you're being led by your nose, and you know you're being set up. Mm-hmm. After a while, it's so obvious. But I was sleeping under a pyramid in Lake Tahoe that every house, every room in the house had a pyramid. Open frame pyramid with gold capstone, including the class one. It was the biggest one. So right above me in a two-story chalet, right above the classroom, I mean, was my bed. So I had it underneath me, and I had it above me with another pyramid with a gold capstone, a skylight in the roof, and the sun would come up in the morning and hit through the skylight and illuminate part of the ceiling, bounce off that gold capstone and hit me right in the face, you know, wake me up. That's what I woke up to in the morning. And that usually what was happening is that I would get a voice in my head that was coming through and talking to me in a twilight state just prior, before this alarm clock would happen, with this gold energy would hit me right in the third eye. And or before I was, it kind of like brought me back into consciousness. And that voice was a sing-songy, very similar to, you know, at first I thought it was the same as Flamine that I described as one of the beings, the female Venusian, that she said she was Venusian, the first two entities that appeared to me, okay? But she then said that her name, like I said, it was like she was singing to me, and but telepathically, okay? And she said her name was Semyasi, but that's how we pronounce it, and it's really Semjasa. And so I said, okay, I knew nothing about this. And so she started giving me data, which I'll just bring it down to a perspective here. It came out to be data on technical data, which is where the poetry was leading. They had to put me through 7 years of training to get out of my own way, just take it down and see, and not think about it, not question it, just it's automatic. And so then I was to the point where I didn't question it anymore. And so this data was coming through her, giving to me, not automatic, but there was still some remnants of automatic when they wanted charts, diagrams, and so forth done. So she started giving me this thing about liquid light being the propulsion system for a spacecraft. And what am I supposed to do with this? Well, this lady I had met that I allude to the involvement in Mount Shasta, that I had a past life flash with as my navigator, and she was extraterrestrial, cooperating in the time of Atlantis, and I was the airship captain, and we just lost the whole afternoon, and it just went into a time warp, and it was the most, up to that point, next to the death experience, it was something like that. It was the most bizarre damn thing, but we both experienced it.
Going through a dimensional doorway, suddenly you were faced with a real-time version of your past incarnation on another dimensional level, which, as many people interpret, are simultaneously going on. Time is the illusion. The linear thing is what we've been brought into to believe, but that isn't the way it is.
Right.
Somebody once said that time is a convention to keep everything happening from everything happening at once.
Right, right.
So you would step through this dimensional portal and saw yourself as an Atlantean airship captain.
Yes, and as a pilot in this life, it was quite, the instrument panel was quite different. It was crystals, and sticking up out of it, it looked like polished aluminum, in a sense, and they were all different colors, and they kind of had a soft pulse to them, like they were alive, and they were pulsing, and as I put my hand over the crystal, it would increase in brightness and pulse, and that was apparently how I propelled the ship, and then I look over to her, and she looks much in this life like she did in the previous, and she wasn't alien looking really, but she had a silver, kind of like a silver lamé jumpsuit on, and I realized what she was doing was she had this I've never seen anything like this before, just like my instrument panel, but that she had this ball that was illuminated that must represent a planet, either the one you're on or in general. And then it had crosshairs going across it like meridian lines, okay? And she was moving her hands across them like this, mm-hmm. and as she did, the lines would move and line up, and that was the navigation.
Obviously evidence that psychokinesis was
right.
an everyday object or something that people would use on a common basis in these other dimensional realms or ancient dimensional realms. Atlanteans, as many people have perceived, had a higher evolved sense of their psychic powers. It's been speculated that, of course, they misused that and it got them into trouble. Some people even believe that it blew up, caused some of the first nuclear reactions that we're faced with. But rather than go in that direction, because I do want to come back and talk about Atlantis, I want to be able to explore more of the Billy Myers case and also get into some of the things that you experienced in Egypt. But we're coming up on the hour right now. We want to take a little bit of a break, give the people another opportunity to take a breath here, and sort of absorb some of this complex levels of information that we're dealing with. We're going into many, many vistas here, folks, so bear with us. We're going to try and sort this out as we get into the show a little bit farther. So hope you're enjoying it, and we'll be back with some more Starseed music from Andrew Forrest. Back with Lawrence Kennedy, Sandra Sisman. We are talking about a myriad of things here, and I know that we could go on a tangent in any one of these directions, and Lawrence could talk for hours as he's been doing over the last couple of days, so I won't tire him out by going reworking a lot of this territory. The main purpose is to bring this information out to you who are listening to these programs. It's timeless information, and it demonstrates how one person has had the opportunity to be exposed to multiple levels of dialogue and information coming in from the different dimensional aspects. And because he's been opening up these doorways, it allows others to realize that such doorways exist and that they can have them open for themselves. This is all leading us. We are all going at a collective conscious. Our consensus reality is shifting. We're allowing in higher frequencies of information to come to us. And this higher frequency is being pulsed out right now from the center, one of the pulse points on planet Gaia, the middle of the Pacific Ocean here on the big island of Hawaii. And then we're welcoming Lawrence and Sandra to our show so that they can just give us some clues as to where this might be going. So bringing us back up to par here, rather than going in depth in the into the Billy Myers story, which is something that could take probably several hours to talk about, just know that Lawrence was brought in as an investigator for this rather spectacular case. There are thousands and thousands of photographs. Some of them look like, the garbage can on a string behind the tree, while others are so spectacular that they defy description. The Billy Myers case, for those of you who are not familiar with it, has gotten a lot of press and has come full circle, sort of like the crop circles, which were taken as a hard science investigation and then later were brought back and exposed by some as being frauds. And now we're back looking at these phenomena as for the real value. Without going into some of the details about that, I want Lawrence to be able to explore some of the information that you gleaned from it. You were not a UFO person at the time. You were brought in as an investigator because of your psychic background. And how was it that Samyiz, am I pronouncing that correctly, the same entity who Billy Meyer had a communication, actually called you in on the case? Is that correct?
Well, yes, but I didn't know where it was going. I just was documenting the stuff, so to speak, as I had learned to just not question it. And this lady that I met in Shasta, that turned out to be my navigator in Atlantis, we had discussed a few things that about like automatic writing, and that she was getting poetry that she compared by looking at some of mine that sounded just like hers. So she thought it might be coming from the same source. So she wanted to see more of it. I just had a couple of the interesting thing, another piece of evidence of why I know it was not of my conscious mind or ego, is I could never remember this stuff afterwards. I'd have to read my own stuff. To this day, I still have to read it because I remember some words in it, but I mean, as far as getting it correct, the rhythm and the rhyme on it, I usually don't do it. So she wanted to do this and wanted to see some more. And so, okay, so I showed her some more, and in doing so, I had mixed in there some of this technical stuff that had the newer stuff that had been come through. And she grabbed, and her just instinctively, she grabbed one of those, and which I had not intended to go into, said, "What is this?" And it said it was about the propulsion system, liquid light, being used by the Pleiadians. And she said, "How did you get this information?" And I said, "The same way. All this other came in. I don't know what to do with it." Well, I found out that, unbeknownst to me, that she was undercover, one of the investigators undercover, and it's because she's a very beautiful lady, and she was an exerciser for Barbra Streisand in Hollywood circles, trying to actually dating Hollywood producers and directors, trying to get the Myers film, Contact, to be produced mainstream as a docudrama with a Star Wars budget. And she was really pushing to get this done. And so she didn't reveal her connection there. And so she's, to this day, she's incognito. So when she told me about that, she said, this information is what is being left out or not. It's not, it's pertinent to the 3,000 pages of direct dialogue that's in the manuscript from the Myers case that I'm privileged to. And I said, "Oh, okay." And she said, "You know who Samyiz is?" And I said, "I haven't got a clue." And she told me who Samyiz was, was the main focal point of the three female occupants, cosmonauts, if you wish, or whatever, that set down the spaceship on the grass, got out and talked to, she did, alone, to Billy Myers and started the whole thing. And so I said, "Oh, that's interesting." And I wasn't into UFO research. I found it intriguing. I taught it in my classes on the surface with Damsky stuff from the 50s and so forth. but I wasn't familiar with, still today I'm not. And so in the interim, she said, now you must, she sent me a photograph that was a privileged photograph at that time that I hadn't published anything. And it was one of the scout ships that today is in the book, okay, UFO Contact in the Pleiades for Volume 1. And I saw that photograph. She opened it up, and the brown envelope came in the mail. And I saw that, and I said, I recognize that ship. And it was like, you just know. When I was, just to paraphrase that, when I was a kid, I messed around with hot rods. And I built a 44 up that got on the front cover of Rod and Custom. It was a beautiful job. 44 coupe. And was candy apple bronze. So if I ever see anything that even resembles a 44 going around, you know, I pay attention to it. Because I put my blood, sweat, and tears into that car. And before going to the Air Force. And so that was the way my recognition was with this spaceship. I knew I'd been inside of it. Okay. It looked, I had seen other photos of other ships, but this one was so detailed and it was so clear and it was just so recognizable. It's like a deja vu. Yeah. So on that stimulus, then I started getting input that my classes were to come to an end. And it was time for them. They, as you mentioned earlier, I was told when I first went to Tahoe that there would only be up front. They said, you're only going to be here for 5 years, and you're going to 900 people, and then you're going to leave. And I went, okay. But I wasn't buying it completely because I really liked Tahoe. And people came to me. I had booked classes 6 months to a year ahead. And it was really from all over the world. And I got publicity. I never had to work for anything. And so all of a sudden it came up with my 900 people, my last class, and the 5 years were up. And my assistant brought it to my attention. And I went, oh, really? I'm kind of disappointed. I have to leave, you know. And then at that same time, I was being directed, and she, after sending the photo, she wanted to make sure that I would contact her when I got to L.A. on the next thing that I flew down to L.A. to do, seminar. And so I did, and as soon as I got there, boy, she was adamant about, she had told Colonel Stevens, Colonel Wendell Stevens is one of the most recognized UFO investigators in the world. And he has probably the largest collection in the world today. And she had told him, and he had made a big point about get him here, okay? And so when I was done with my seminar, she said, I booked flight. Nobody knew we were on that flight. We didn't even go on by name and just jumped this commuter flight to Tucson. And Wendell picked us up, and we had a fascinating afternoon. And she had to return that evening and return flight because the demands of Robert Streisand and others. She couldn't stay. But Wendell and I went around and around exchanging information. And it came down to how much it was sort of like a Mexican standoff. I needed the manuscript in complete form in order to go on further and with what he wanted. See, it was like an exchange thing. And also some photographs. And he was really quite guarded with this material because they hadn't published the books yet. And he was involved with financial people in publishing Genesis 3 and so forth. So it was really ticklish. And so he finally had to say, I can't do anything. And so I was to catch a plane the next day at 1 o'clock. And we were up until 3 o'clock in the morning going over things. So I figured I'd sleep in. And about 8 o'clock in the morning, he's banging on my door, which I thought was kind of interesting. And he woke me up and he said, Lawrence, you're going to have to get up if you want this material that you asked for, because I have to hand walk it through all the copying machines. I don't let it out of my hands. the manuscript, the original work, and the same thing with the photographs. He hand walks it all through. This man's an old intelligence officer, and he leaves nothing. He's also Capricorn, and he leaves nothing for chance, right? And so he does triplicate on everything. And so we did that, and then I was off, and I asked him why he changed his mind. And he said, because he was quite adamant about it, and he said, well, I got a phone call at 4 o'clock in the morning, and he said, it was from Myers in Switzerland. And he said, that's not unusual, because Myers has had, up to that point, about 7 major assassination attempts on his life. So they're always kind of half expecting bad news or whatever. And he said, but 4 o'clock in the morning, I thought something was seriously wrong. And he knows better than to call me in a time zone. And he just said, real simply, he just said, which is daytime in Switzerland, you know? And he just said, do you have somebody there by the name of Kennedy? And Wendell said, yeah, but nobody knows he's here. And Myers just said, well, Sam Yossi said to bring him aboard on the case. Now, that was how it started.
And you were how long, how many years were you involved in that case?
Well, we finally put our efforts together, which I ended up having to protect that film even more so than Contact. Contact managed to get out. As a matter of fact, at a break, Sandra was talking about the E.T. ball. That was a front to show it to show Contact, a premier showing, in one of 6 different designated places as a premiere showing, which they were going to see the audience reaction to it and then make some changes, final edits, okay? And that was in Boulder, Colorado. And when Sarah and I first got together, then she didn't really realize how crazy I really was with this stuff, you know? And I was on tour at the UFO Society in Denver, had accepted me in place of Wendell reluctantly because Wendell had received information on possible threats if he were to go at a major conference. So he paid attention to these, and he said, I'm not going to go, but it's a shame to waste it. And I was the only one that would lecture in the whole group. The rest of them were all just investigators, and they wouldn't talk about the case. So that's what brought me there and kind of indirectly connected Sandra and I.
So you were brought together by the Billy Meier case in an offhanded way, and it sounds as if you've been asked to be kind of the spokesperson for these kinds of information ever since your death experience, maybe even before.
Well, it got us into a lot, just like with my son, the stress that came about, government, whatever you want to call it, secret government, shadow government, worldwide thing, or whatever. It was the same thing, that they're closely paralleled. Psychic phenomena and UFO stuff is very close because so much of it comes from that source too, or stimulated or whatever, or they're really afraid that if you get into or concern those who are pulling the strings from behind the scenes are really concerned that you just might find out something about through paranormal, and in doing so, you might just hook up with higher intelligence that just might put them in a compromising position, you know? So all that is associated. So when Wendell and I came together, it stirred up some stuff on a lot of circles. And Wendell had warned me, and he actually said, when he brought me on the case, he had me checked out with his intelligence sources. And he said, do you have any idea how big the file is on you? He said, like that, you know.
And well, it's amazing you're still around.
That's
and
right.
You're able to go, and you've been traveling for all these years, presenting your information either publicly as a presenter or off the grid, so to speak, with people who come to these conventions. And yet they've allowed you to continue. The informational flow is still out there. You're still living and walking and talking. Your son hasn't been abducted and held hostage so that you would shut up. How do you account for that?
Oh, same way that Myers does. Myers survived 7, and that was in the early days, 7 major assassination attempts. his life. And they were precision attempts, assassins. One of them, Wendell, was sitting right alongside of him in a stucco wall in a farmhouse behind him and sitting on a bench. And Myers got a pain in his side and said, went like this. Just as he did, they caused the pain in his side. A high-powered rifle bullet, hit the wall and splattered stucco all over Wendell. Now, Wendell's an old combat pilot, an intelligence officer, squadron commander, World War II, but still freaked him out, you know, a little bit. And that was just one incident, okay? So it's the same way that Myers gets alerted and they seem to intervene on his behalf to keep him alive. And they did. I get the same thing, the same treatment. But my source is, I don't know if I can say it's different. It's just coming from my source, okay? And they keep me jig-jogging through, and I get little warnings about things that before they happen most of the time, and then I can avoid it.
Well, now you've moved to Montana, which is way out in the middle of nowhere. A lot of people who live in Montana like it because their thought forms and waves aren't interrupted by interference patterns that one would find in the denser populated areas. Was this the attraction, or is it that you can actually continue your lifestyle and go to these places without this pall of interference?
I think it was more moving to Montana was... We actually had to edge our way there. As I'm an old California boy. We're in Southern California. And I'm a sun worshiper, man. And I got to have the water, you know. And so everywhere we moved along the way, it was to a big, huge lake. We go from lake to lake to lake like that. And even where we are today, the same thing. Yeah, the Flathead Lake is 60 miles long, and it's kidney-shaped, but it's like Lake Tahoe, but stretched out. And it's a resort area. And again, the same thing. We seem to always be attracted to the lakes and the resort areas and pristine areas. Where we are now seems to be one of the most pristine areas, air quality-wise, water-wise, so forth. And we're actually living on tribal reservation land. In fact, just down the street from tribal headquarters, if you want to call it a street. So in a way, in some respects, It's a bit removed, and Montana's pretty sparsely populated anyway, and you find that people live there, it's not a big income state for sure, and so especially where we are, it relies primarily on tourism, okay, and then there's all this recovery from the timber industry, and the mining industry is on the east part. We're in the west coast, or I should say the west side of the Rockies, is much more plush and with a lot of trees and lakes, and it's completely different than eastern Montana. I don't relate to eastern Montana at all.
Well, I characterize the Big Island of Hawaii as being Montana with the ocean, because there was a similar kind of openness, the big sky that was overhead, and the kind of clean air, if you will, the clean frequency vibrations. Well, this has kind of led us into, and again, we can go down this road and talk about Billy Myers for a couple of hours. I know that you had some extraordinary experiences while you were in Egypt that helped you to open up to developing the tool for star people. And I would like to get into that with you about the Ankh and star people in general. Star people is a term coined from Brad Steiger's books, and it refers to what we believe is a seeded intelligence, a genetic coded intelligence that people are waking up to, a certain factor. Now, I think you mentioned something like 5% of the people are star-seeded. Maybe that figure has changed, or maybe it's growing. Maybe all of us are star-seeded, and we're waking up as these new DNA codes are coming and being reactivated, the so-called junk DNA. Do you feel at all that this information, and over the last 20 or 25 years that you've been on the trail, that there's been an opening and an expansion, and more people are opening up to this information and thus identifying themselves as potential star beings?
Yes, I think it's an evolutionary process that's been going on, and the evidence of that is that it appears, and if you look at it from different perspectives, it appears that we're digging a big hole, you know, humanity, with the planet. I mean, this Mother is all we've got. You know, the aspect of going to Mars is a joke, but I won't get into that. Anyway, it's a political football. But we can't take care of this planet. We've abused this planet, and it's just ludicrous to even consider going in and farming a new planet, right? Which is what it would require, just astronomical, okay? To say nothing of the karmic factors involved with that planet. So we're not on our own turf there. And so I would say that what's happening is that this process of digging our own grave, so to speak, that appears to a lot of people, and then this is waking up a lot of people on the planet or stimulating them to be environmentalists, etc., to pay attention and take responsibility for what we're doing. You know, and if you pay attention to nature in all stages, you see recycling. And we're the exception. We're wasteful, and we're polluters. You know, and so the only thing I can relate it to is, which is doesn't even hold water on that end of it, is like viruses or bacteria, as an example, parasites that are being hosted in, by a body. Now, see, the Earth is hosting us, and we're the parasites.
Yeah,
okay,
the virus, as described in the movie The Matrix, I find interesting and very appropriate.
But the difference is, parasites or viruses have enough sense to not kill the host, you see? And so that doesn't make any sense either. So then the only other answer can be, if that's not the way it's going to go, is that it's a wake-up call. That we, I relate it to something that I picked up from Ramtha's teachings a long time ago when Sandra and I viewed some of that or went and experienced some of that, Jay-Z Knight. And Ramtha said, related to the Earth as a sandbox, and then we're like a cat, and then we go and defecate in, into the sandbox, right? And then you just keep doing this and been piling more sand in different places, moving it around, till pretty soon the sandbox is full. Not so much sand anymore, it's a whole lot of other stuff. And so the cat will then refuse to go into that sandbox because he's intelligent enough to know, you see, that he's not going to go into his own pollution anymore if you don't change that sandbox. When the, out in the world, he doesn't have that problem, okay, but in a confined space, he does. So I relate that to what we're doing with the planet. We only got one sandbox, see, and we're screwing it up. And what we're doing is just burying ourselves in our own defecate, okay? So,
where do we go as star beings or people who are recognizing our consciousness coming from the stars? What's the purpose of that now so that we begin to recognize and sort of respect our sandbox on another level? Is that why this information is becoming available now?
We are so hypnotized by materialism. And it just in lately, it's just coming on so fast and in heaps and mounds that you can't keep up with it. You know, I mean, like you, one day you get a cell phone or you get a CD, and next day it's out of date. I mean, computers go out within a year. Okay, they're obsolete, and it's just accelerating so fast. And so I think this acceleration is all part of it, so that it's a speeded up process to hurry up and catch up to where they would like us to be able to open up our eyes, okay? Now, along the way, some of us who are more astute are already opening up our eyes and doing something about it. But there's still a lot of those out there that are caught up in the programming. The illusion is so great, and they keep reinforcing it and making it stronger and stronger every day, right? Mm-hmm. That we have to have, it's like a cashless society. We have to have our credit cards, we have to have this, we have to have that. It used to be keeping up with the Joneses. There used to be an old joke that I used to tell about that. It's real brief. You know, this guy, he moves into this neighborhood, and he's a multimillionaire. Of course, that doesn't mean anything today. He's more like a billionaire. But he moves into a middle-class neighborhood. And, of course, he's driving his Lincoln Continental and whatever, and his Mark IV and Mark VI. And And so finally his neighbor couldn't stand it any longer, had to ask him, you're obviously rolling in wealth. You know, he had all these things. And he moved into a middle-class neighborhood, and he had the house completely remodeled to make it look like a mansion and added on. He said, why did you choose this neighborhood if you've got all this? You could go anywhere. And he said, because all my life I had to work myself up through the ranks. And I wasn't born with a silver spoon in my mouth. All my life I had to learn to keep up with the Joneses. Here, I'm Jones. See what I mean?
Uh-huh. I think I see what you mean. So we're heading towards, it's kind of funny, coming full circle. We talked about the material world is an illusion, and yet so much of our energy now is going to be drawn by that illusion so that we can repair the material world. So kind of going back to where we started this conversation, you had an awakening when you went to the other side, saw the edge between the two worlds, saw an illusionary curtain that was being drawn back to show you that it was just thin. And yet, so much attention now, even in your own work, is describing that illusion back to us so that we can get a different handle and stop doing these detrimental things to this illusionary reality. So it seems almost it's like contradictory, isn't it? I mean, at one point it's an illusion, and the other point, well, and yet here we have all this incredible information about our history, the aliens, the Egyptians, the Atlanteans. Isn't that all part of the same illusion?
Yes, I suppose you could say that, except that if you want to call that reality, but if you don't get your reality straight, even though that's an illusion, you got to get your illusion straight, otherwise it does no longer is an illusion. You see what I mean? It does not serve a purpose in psychology. It can't be an illusion if the illusion is scattered and you don't hold your focus on it. How can you be hypnotized? You see what I mean? Which is exactly what's going on. It's hypnosis. See? So we hold the attachment to the illusion through constantly being reminded that it's the reality, right? Okay.
What I'd like to do now is take another last of our breaks, come back, and I want to direct your attention to some of the Atlantean information that you might be able to share with us, and this relationship to what we're talking about, cetaceans, dolphins and whales, because I know our audience is interested in that. I know there is a primary interest on your part, and maybe there's some things that you can share from what you've picked up and help us get a new handle and a new focus on where this might be going. So we're going to listen to some more Starseed and be back in a short to wrap this show up. Hang with us. It's been fun, and we'll look forward to more just after this little break. coming back into planet Earth from the deep, deep space. And we have been into the spatial realms during this hour and a half. We have about another 30 minutes to continue to delve into these fascinating areas. And if you've been listening as attentively as I have, we can go for hours in any one of these tangents. And for the last couple of days, I've been privileged to hear Dr. Kennedy talk about some of his exploits. And I think rather than trying to cover the Egyptian story, which is really fascinating in itself, I'd like to skip right to some of the reference points from the Egyptians, which was the Sirius connection. Sirius, as we know, was the brightest star in the heavens. It's still very bright, but it was actually the access point for the Egyptians. It's been noted by several scholars that one of the air vents actually went directly out of the king's chamber to and pointed directly at Sirius, which was the North Star at the time. It's also been noted as the Dog Star. And for some of you aficionados out there, you recognize that Sirius has a history associated with dolphins. The African tribe, the Dogons, recognized that the Sirius star, Sirius, actually had a cluster, a Sirius A and Sirius B, with revolving moons around the two suns and planetoids around the two suns, way before they could have any possible technological way of knowing this. So intuitively, this ancient tribe was able to describe the descendants of what they termed were the dolphin people. There seems to be a connection. We're talking about star people. This is your associated clue. The dolphins have been noted as being associated. Joan Ocean has made note that she feels that the dolphin and the cetacean consciousness is related to star clusters. I have my own intuition on that, and I'm curious to know what you have to share about dolphins and whales.
Well, it's interesting that I did pay attention to that particular program. Alan Landsberg, I got to know him personally, who produces In Search Of, Leonard Nimoy. The documentation that was done on that particular show, because they did one on myself, too, and my son, very interesting, but it's a parallel with what I'm aware of in the Myers case. I'm trying to find a home turf here that we can spring from. Let me just start off by saying that in the manuscript of the Pleiades, they cite to Myers that at that point in 70, the case was ongoing for 2 years, 75, 76, and then it's still what is continuing even to today, but it was direct dialogue, face-to-face contact, 3,000 pages of dialogue up in those 2 years. And that's what we had to work with. And what they refer to is that there are, at that point in time, which has accelerated considerably, there was 38 different civilizations currently visiting Earth. And I think our egos get overinflated with, they're coming to see us and why we're so important and all that. Some of them are just tourists, like you guys get used to on this island, right? You can pick them out. Okay. All right. So, and they're just hit and run. They're just tourists passing through, maybe getting a water stop, maybe pulling from a power line or water. Water is very precious in the universe, by the way. So that's one of the reasons they do that. But all these different civilizations, the 38, there's more now, considerably more. And it's probably more than double that factor.
57 was a number brought out by the Stephen Greer Commission, which had a guy said that they've identified 57 or 58 varieties, and that's just from the military standpoint.
But as far as the connection with Egypt goes, they did emphasize two, as you stated, and I found that to be very evident in Egypt with the air passageway focused directly like a telescope almost on Sirius. Now, interestingly enough, that the Sirius, they seem to build temples in alignment to that and coordinate certain things, but then in the writings it was more evident, or in the hieroglyphics, there was more emphasis put on the Pleiades. And there's definitely was this thing going on simultaneously. And, of course, in the Myers case, they do allude to the fact that Sirius, some part of the Sirius section, the system, not all, it's just like there are certain parts of Orion that are negative and positive, okay, split, as an example, and the Pleiades, and where their origin is, and it's really kind of more important to, as far as the Pleiades go, to know where they came from and what their interconnection is with us. I can relate to that a little bit better than I can the Sirius connection. Sirius, they cooperated at a point to help release us from our enslavement that had been created on this planet, and the human race was originally genetically designed as a slave race to mine gold by Dracos, which are reptilians, who are always in the foreground somewhere, in behind the scenes somewhere, pulling the strings. Up until recently, they had no real exposure, and they won it that way, okay? It would take a whole afternoon just to talk about them. So I'm not going to get off on that, but I will say that with the Pleiades, that they came originally, they did not originate in the Pleiades, and that was one of the big objections that the astronomers made on the case, would say the system is too young, it's got the plasma between the stars, it's a beautiful looking system, but it's way too young in its infancy, in its amoeba stage, or its embryo stage, like to be able to support life, the suns and such, the planets evolving. Well, that's all true, but they are there on a sun, Electra, which is one of them, one of the seven that we actually, there's nine, but that we actually see seven without a telescope, and it looks like an upside down little dipper, and it's one of the most beautiful systems in the sky, night sky, and that you can see with the naked eye. So it's been romantically referred to, and sure association with our down through history by almost every civilization. The Greeks fantasized with it. The Romans, of course, picked it up as well. The Babylonians talked about it. Even the Huna describes the Polynesians describe the influence of the Pleiades. And really, if you want to really reach our Christian Bible, has seven major references to the Pleiades as teachers. Okay, one of them is in Job, in conversation with God, says, if I can quote it correctly, Job in conversation, he says, "Oh Lord, but if we could, resemble, it's not, that's not the right word. If we could make, the word is not the correct word, but it's, if we could appear to be like the Pleiades," there's another word, "and unshackle the binds of Orion." So it clearly defines the fact that the Pleiades were teachers that they wanted to resemble, and that Orion, that the dark force, or what, was coming from the Orion belt, okay, or a portion of it. And that's right in the Bible. I think it's Job 23:21, something like that. But I'm sorry about goofing that one up. I used to know it by heart. Anyway, the reference is there. And so the Pleiades have a prominent position with the Egyptians that I'm positive is a carryover from Atlantis, and possibly even a greater influence there. And the Egyptian Empire started at a very high level of technology, and the mystery is what happened, okay, is that it suddenly went into decline. And although they continued to build temples and pyramids, et cetera, most of the stuff that we found ourselves with major Egyptologists with us was dated wrong, okay? And we proved it by the redating process, by things we found like crystals, salt crystals, ocean water, salt crystals growing inside the King's Chamber, dated by an Air Force chemist 35 years. as at 12,500 years old, that were ocean water, that were microorganisms in them, and a high degree of potassium that had been picked up from passage through the limestone blocks from the surface. And it confirmed the stain around the ring, around the just below the air passageway that is open. And that was just one of the things that we found that emphasized the dating, changed a lot of the dating process. But the Pleiades have other very dominant or very prominent things, like in the ceiling, three stories down, the largest tomb arrangement at three big, huge stories levels that are the tomb that's been, it's been raided, but there's nothing there, but the drawings or frescoes on the walls, they are very vivid. And it was for the mummy, we actually have the mummy from Ramses II, the great Ramses that built the about 30% of Karnak in Luxor, which couldn't possibly have been done in one lifetime. Well, we have his mummy, and he's got a very elongated skull, and it hasn't been manipulated. That's the interesting thing about all these elongated skulls. However, it's been, I can't remember the tribe now, it's not the Zulu, but in Africa, that does mimic, and you brought up the dog star, there's a tribe in Africa that put rings around and form the in a child's head when it's soft from the birth on, and they use just women, not the men, just women, and they have the significance there is that they're mimicking the gods, which is the same way that once happened with the dog star, where these extraterrestrials, if you wish, came down and connected with natives, and certain information came forward, but apparently because they left, then the technology wasn't boosted enough to be able to maintain and support itself. I think we see evidence of this all over the place. We see it with the disappearance of the Mayan. When the Aztecs came, they found the temples and everything, the pyramids, all empty, and they just continued to use them, but they did not build them. Okay, we find all kinds of evidence all over the planet like that.
When would you say that the root race, the human root race that was brought here as a genetic strand by the Draconians, changed through the assistance of the Pleiadians into a whole human race that was no longer a slave race?
Well,
we have a time frame.
My information source was already in its formative stages and before I got into the Myers case, but it just supported it more. And basically what they allude to in relationship to creation is that first off that they say, which it's kind of set some religious people back, and what they're, a big thing that they're afraid of, if you wish, is a contradiction on religion, you know. But they say, that we recognize your gods, you know, your Jesus and your Buddha and so forth, your masters, your teachers. But you have to understand that they are limited to your planet, okay? When you go outside of your system here, there are other gods, multiples beyond what you can imagine, okay? So you can't expect us to just get overly enthralled with yours, except the respect factor of what the masters are, see? And so they go on to talk about that. And so religion is just one of the aspects that they kind of poke holes through, you know. And then our existence here, where that's how they got involved with us. See, people say, well, why aren't they putting forth the effort? They're this far advanced, 3,000 years advanced to us in technology, interdimensional travels, time travelers, and they don't have any defense systems on there. Interesting to our government when we try to shoot them down. They have no defense systems on their spacecraft. They don't need them because their offensive or their defense system is that they can manipulate time. You see? They can just, you shoot a bullet at them, they just get out of the way, just like they did with Myers. See? They don't want the karma associated with the violence. Okay? So, just move out of the way. And I think that this is an Eastern teaching, right, in martial arts, isn't it not?
Yeah,
the weight of the opponent against him, right, mm-hmm. and to his own disadvantage. Mm-hmm. You see.
So we're looking at a time frame of 50,000, a million years. Some people say 5 million years when this human genome was developed.
Well, I will go back to when I first started to give a plan here. 20,000 years ago, the Pleiadians existed on a planet that is gone now. The whole star system has been vaporized, and it was in the system called Lyra, and now it's referred to, ironically, by astronomers. The nickname of it is called the Eye of God. It looks like an eye in space. Beautiful. And it's gone to Nova, the sun went Nova, with a little star in the middle with a black pupil-like and a ring, of colorful ring. Well, that's where they came from. And they participated, or at least part of the Pleiadian people, the Lyrans, participated in this destructive procedure that was shown very, very brilliantly in Star Wars. Okay? Star Wars has its purpose, and it's really, for all intents and purposes, real. It's a story of our struggle with the materialism and with that element. Well, that was going on in Lyra, and they were up to a point of literally destroying planets in their system. And I'm not sure if I remember how many planets, but it was comparable to ours. And they were literally vaporizing planets. And at that point, their sun, which is a god, he is everything comes through, by the way. That's why I wrote the book, Thunder Stage of Chains, on solar flares. Because solar flares are triggers to what our consciousness is happening, radiation.
And right now, we've had some of the most phenomenal solar flares in all recorded history in the last months or so, right?
That's right. And that's... But when I, given the information of solar flares, they were not nearly as prominent as they are today, like 96. Okay? And I was writing about all this projection, and everybody thought I was a little, a bit optimistic or a bit of an alarmist. And I was just saying, well, it's going to be dramatic, and it's going to change the weather. And a lot of things. It stimulates earthquakes and volcanic activity. I mean, Ra, or the sun god, nothing happens that is in his domain, which is, this solar system is his domain. And the planets are his children. Okay? And forget about cosmos. They didn't come out of cosmic dust. You know, they were spewed, just like, including the Polynesians, refer to the birth of planets coming out of the sun, all right? And that's exactly, so do the Babylonians, so the Egyptians, so forth. Academics are the only ones that insist on this other fairy tale. Anyway, so nothing happens that doesn't come through the sun. This is his domain, and he is in control. He is not a tyrant. He is just a reflector. He's a beautiful mirror that reflects from Alcyon, the central sun, in the center of our galaxy, which it goes on up through a corporate structure. That's the way everything's set up. And so he is reacting in the way the book was put forth, and the way they wanted me to put this out there. And I said, how am I going to describe that? And they said, well, it's simple. He's reacting to a holographic expression. He's creating a holographic expression of what's occurring on the Earth. Oh, fine. That's what sunspots are. They're little miniature black holes, or cancer, or like, in a sense, or like the breaks in a Curlian ore. If you take the Curlian ore with breaks in, you put it up against a blocked out version of a solar eclipse, as an example, it looks amazingly similar, okay?
It does indeed,
and it's corona, see? Which is just nature repeating itself again. So we're just seeing reflected holographically because we're seeing a two-dimensional image flat in a sense this way, not so much three-dimensional, although they have it now. So, but we're seeing this this expression holographically of what is being reflected from the earth in negative aspect. And so that's what I wrote the book to put the two together, because you can superimpose the sun, the solar spots over the top of the earth and see where the weak spots are. It paralleled my first book, Terror and Transition, which showed the lines where the weak spots intersected. Okay, trauma that the earth, Mother Earth, daughter of the sun, is being abused, okay?
Well, somebody noted that the sunspots seem to form at the latitude of 19.5 degrees and then move towards the equator, and that 19.5 degrees has been identified as a power aspect, a power meridian on the planets of our solar system. The 19.5 comes right through here at the volcano, which is an obviously an upwelling power spot, just as we see the perpetual storm on Jupiter. And so the sun seems to reflect the same kind of energetics that we have noticed. There's a lot of activity now, a lot of interest in solar flares, because it's been speculated that if we were in the wrong trajectory, one of those flares could just turn us to toast in a matter of seconds.
That's right. As a matter of fact, if I can just interject that up until a couple years ago, and even today, academically, they continue to fall back on this one, that, you know, the big asteroid trip that hit this planet and eliminated the dinosaurs, there's still a lot of fluctuation on all that. Now they're trying to pin it on a disease factor or something. Well, one of the problems with finding in paleontology, finding bone compositions here and there, is that if it would have been a mass destruction, there would have been mass graves. And that's what they can't explain. There are not mass graves. And it looked like, apparently, that they died out over a period of about 100 years. They weren't in pocket areas unless it was a volcano exploding or something that wasn't enough to do the whole planet. So why is it an influence over the whole planet, you see? Okay, the only thing we explain that is and we wouldn't have recognized it if it hadn't been for Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Because when that happened, when we saw for the first time what radiation would do, it'll vaporize matter and just leave a shadow behind on a wall of what was a human being, as an example. And also, radiation became obvious in the termination of people because they became sterilized, okay? If you stop and reflect on it for a minute, if you're nature, if you're a what we call a demigod, or those who are hosting or part of the creator god aspect, okay, that is far removed from our little realities in a sense, but still in connection. If they decided that the dinosaurs had run their course, and there's a lot of evidence that shows they were around for millions of years. We haven't been around them, okay? And so if they ran their course on the planet and did what they were supposed to do, and you suddenly say, well, it's time to draw that to a conclusion, you know, an agreement, or however, okay, then what's the kindest way of putting that one asunder is just sterilize, right? Sterilization. Because then it's just they just die out on their own accord, okay? The solar flares are capable of that, and big time. And also, in addition to that, in changing our DNA, if there was one single factor that could change in mass our DNA on this planet without us really being, traumatized by it or affected directly in our consciousness, it would have to be radiation. And everybody gets excited when they hear the word radiation, because radiation always seems to be bad because of what we've created. But it isn't. It's just an acceleration of electron activity that, in physics, that if our organs cannot tolerate them, they fry. That's all. Because the frequency is higher than we can handle, the gamma rays. You see? So it's the same thing with that which comes from the sun. And the same thing they found in Hiroshima and Nagasaki. They found a priest and some nuns, and a priest died underground. They were below ground level. He died and immediately in the first shockwave within a mile. Okay, but one of the nuns survived. And they watched her, and she's now 85 years old, still alive. And they now, since they broke the genome code, they're studying her. What's different about her? There's something different about her DNA, you see? So throughout the planet, and this is actually the point, I'm not saying that she's a star person, but that's a very good possibility that she could handle a higher accelerated radiation count or higher frequency of gamma, okay, than the others, okay? Because 30 miles away, they were still dying of radiation poisoning.
Sure.
You see?
Yeah.
Okay.
It's phenomenal. And, of course, we could continue on these lines. It's been suggested that the solar flares are indeed radiating our DNA codes, changing our chromosomal patterns so that we can accommodate this higher frequency of information that's coming in or that we are graduating to, and maybe in the nick of time to save us from self-destruction, self-extinction. Maybe it's all part of a grand scheme of unfoldment here. I know that you're going to be here for a couple of more days, and we'll maybe take this opportunity to expose yourself to getting in the water, maybe looking face-to-face with a smiling dolphin coming back at you. I was hoping that some of the travels that you've gone to had exposed you to some of that information, but maybe that's yet to come. And the purpose of your being here is to bring your incredible bank and wealth of information full circle and have another reflective mirror as to what it might look like from another sentient race perspective. We do have the proof that there is a sentient race, a 3D sentient race that occupies planet Earth, and they've been here for several million years longer than we have. And they were intelligent enough as a mammalian species to move back into the water and to use that as their medium of survival. So there's many, many things that we've learned by being dolphin people here on the Big Island. And maybe in your experience here, we'll be able to share some of those with you. If there is time, maybe perhaps later before you leave the island, and maybe after that experience, we'll have another opportunity to come together, and if time permits, maybe even tapes more so that we can share this with the radio audience. But our 2 hours has gone through very, very quickly, and I can just see the expression as you're waking up and getting used to sharing this information. We haven't had any chance to talk with Sandra at all. I'm sorry to say that, but she's been here energetically, very supportive of this, and very, very happily giving us wonderful radiance that is her being. She is definitely has the twinkle in the eye as the star people. I was hoping to get into some of the characteristics, but this may have to wait for another future time when we can come back at this whole subject. We have some really interesting background information that we have, and maybe there'll be an opportunity to add another tier of that awareness. So I want to thank both of you for being so kind with your time and generosity. I know that a lot of people are pulling at your sleeve for being able to share your experiences and some of your depth abilities. Yes. So thank you, Sandra, for being here and sharing that. I know that you've got some people who are standing in the wings looking for your expertise and some of the things that you share with them for your body modalities. And the both of you do readings, the Clarion photography, Curlian photography that you have developed is a tool for helping people analyze some of these things. So without going any more into detail, I just want to thank you both very much for being a part of this. And if time permits, maybe we'll be able to get some more information to you and come back and do this again real soon. I want to thank the audience for being here, and most of all, I want to thank Randy at photon.net for allowing us to broadcast this out and give people the opportunity to share in this information. For those of you who are interested in this material, and I'm sure a lot of you will be, I want you to know that you can access this. Lawrence and Sandra are on the circuit. They are from Montana, but they move around. Let me just give you some ways of contacting them and more information. They are developing a couple websites, but for the time being, if you want to look at some of the information that they have out there, you can access it on the Internet. It's www.ronan, that's spelled R-O-N-A-N, .net/, and then you have that little squiggly line, which I always forget the name of, but Matilda, Walsing Matilda, and then the word Star Run Limited, and I'll pronounce it, it's Star Unlimited, Starunltd. So once again, www.ronan.net/*Unlimited, and Star Unlimited, Starunltd, at ronan.net is the email address that allow you to contact them. They're stationed in Montana, but they move around quite a bit. Sandra, please add.
Yes, we also have www.starlineunlimited spelled out. .com. Okay. So you can try that too.
Very good, very good. There's a whole bunch of tools that they've developed from honks and zappers and pulsing laser and laser lights. Fascinating stuff. Elixir, water, biomagnetics, all kinds of things. So please check it out online, and maybe we'll hear more next time we have a chance to share it. So thank you again. In the meantime, this is Dolphinus. Thank you very much for joining us. We'll look forward to being with you next time, whenever that might be. Remember, what you believe is true, folks, and that's the whole nature of why we're here, to change that reality through our heart-mind belief system. Thanks for joining us, and as dolphins have told me, I'll share with you to be well and swim free. Until next time, see you.